Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, the headlines have caused the world to focus its attention squarely and almost completely on the Middle East in the aftermath of the recent attacks on Israel by Iran. Meanwhile, Russia is continuing its war of aggression into Ukraine, and the needed aid from the U.S. Is still looming in the House and the Senate. The president did just come out in the last few hours in support of Speaker of the House Mike Johnson's proposal. But the interesting thing is, in terms of the strategy and a strained relationship between Kyiv and Washington, D.C., we want to get underneath the headlines and see how that's playing out. What effect that's going to have on Ukraine and the war effort there. So let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Well, it's time to think again about what we think we know, and especially as it relates to Ukraine and their strategy in battling and dealing with Russian aggression. And we want to get into that with Dan Lamothe, of course, national security reporter for The Washington Post. And Dan joins us live on the line. Dan, welcome to the show. And as you look at this, Ukrainians have been looking at some different things that are a little further into Russia than I think the U.S. has been comfortable with. As you continue to cover this and watch this, what are you seeing and what are you watching in terms of how this is playing out?
Yeah, I think there's a couple notable things ongoing at the same time. One is that as Ukraine is sort of trying to fend this attack off in any way it can, it has launched a series of long-range strikes well into Russia, trying to target refineries and other things that would be valuable to Russia. I think trying to limit Russia's economy to some degree. And also, I think just, you know, make the point that they, too, can strike on other on their adversaries' turf.
Yeah.
While that's going on, though, we've also got this, complete paralysis in terms of delivering serious amounts of aid to Ukraine. It's been caught up in the House for months now. And we saw President Biden put out a statement today, but that's on the heels of a number of congressional hearings in recent days where you had General Cavoli of European Command and other senior Pentagon officials basically saying the moment's now and that within a matter of weeks, perhaps at this point, maybe a week, Russia will enjoy a 10-to-1 advantage with artillery shells over Ukraine.
Mm. Wow. And that is a stunning number to wonder how in the world you can do a 10-to-1 and have any kind of chance of even holding any ground, let alone trying to gain any of that back. I think it's been interesting, too. Obviously, the administration has challenges in terms of messages that they're sending to Iran and then to Israel and then to Vladimir Putin. But also, the administration has been sending some of those messages to Ukraine to say, "Hey, don't go after those oil refineries." And yet, the President Zelensky seems to be disregarding that and saying, "Hey, we have to do something, and this is our strategy."
Yeah, this goes back sometime at this point. Vice President Harris apparently delivered this message on her visit to Kyiv a while back. And it was received very poorly. But the United States has followed up with a number of other individuals delivering effectively the same message. You know, the point being that this makes the war unpredictable. This makes the war a little more challenging for the United States to support. From the Ukrainian perspective, they look at it as something they can do in a time of desperation.
Yeah, and I think as they do that, it seems to me that that Kyiv is getting increasingly exhausted or exasperated by the inaction of the United States. I thought one of the comments coming out from one of the Ukrainian officials saying, surely the mightiest military on the planet can find some batteries of Patriots that can help the only country in the world that's fighting ballistic attacks every day. So it seems to be growing tension in terms of the inaction here in the U.S. What else are you hearing, both in terms of the U.S., but then also how is this playing out with the other allies in Europe that are much closer to the fight?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen Poland, the Baltic states, Finland, other countries that are much closer to the fight, that are willing and able to send some degree of aid. And in terms of kind of percentage, they're actually sending a greater percentage than the United States is of its own gross domestic product. I think the challenge becomes it takes a lot of those smaller countries to sort of add up to what the United States has in its arsenal. A lot of these things are available. They're in the U.S. arsenal. The problem is it requires congressional authorization. That authorization has not come. The previous tranche of money was used, and we've gone a couple months now, really going back to late last fall, with very little aid available.
Yeah, and is there any other real case in terms of why Ukraine should not go after some of those kinds of targets, whether it's energy production capabilities or those kinds of places or targets?
I think from the U.S. perspective, they've been trying to manage a war with a lot of unpredictability in it, with nuclear weapons potentially involved. And it's just if the situation can be contained, I think from the U.S. perspective, U.S. interests, the White House sees that as a better bet.
Yeah.
The Ukrainian perspective on this obviously would vary.
Yeah, no question. And then just give us one thing in closing here, Dan. What's something that we should be watching for in the days ahead beyond the battle that's going to continue to play out in the House this week? What else should we be watching as it relates to Ukraine and their battle against Russia?
There's been a lot of talk about whether or not Russia can break through in a serious way. You know, we've seen the front lines very, very well paralyzed for months now. After Ukraine's counteroffensive last year didn't go all that well. The concern becomes that the longer Ukraine goes without serious aid to kind of shoot back and hold the Russians where they are, you run the risk that Russia is able to kind of burst through, kind of collapse the front line, and then it becomes a much more dynamic situation.
Yeah, and it does seem that Ukraine hasn't had they've had kind of the just enough to keep things there, which is why I think the offensive may have been oversold or perceptionally oversold in terms of what could be done, because it was really, you know, inches and yards at a time without the capability to do some of those deeper strike things where you can soften up behind a line and then, you know, get some momentum rolling in. And I think what you're saying, Dan, is that the reverse could also happen from Russia's standpoint, that they've been pounding on that line, but they may be able to break through, and then everything changes.
That's right. If you can get behind the Ukrainian front lines, it becomes a much more complex situation.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. We'll continue to watch this very close this week. Dan Lamoth, national security reporter for the Washington Post. Dan, always appreciate your perspective. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Again, that's Dan Lamoth, national security reporter for the Washington Post. And it's so interesting. The dynamics are so complicated. And here the U.S. is saying, hey, don't do this. Don't go after those oil refineries. Again, worried about possible nuclear retaliation coming from Vladimir Putin. The U.S. trying to navigate all of that. And I think this has to be one of those cases where if you're always just trying to ratchet down, is that always the best strategy? And trying to appease everybody, do you end up appeasing nobody and causing the greater, wider conflict that you're trying to avoid? There's a lot in there. We'll continue to watch it and unpack it as we move it forward on Inside Sources. We'll be right back.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson. Get deeper insights on the news from Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. Great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson. And of course, as we continue to watch the 2024 election cycle rumble along, President Joe Biden is on a campaign blitz this week across the state of Pennsylvania. Yesterday, he spoke in one of his favorite spots, Scranton. Today, he's going to give remarks in Pittsburgh and then go on to Philadelphia on Thursday. And it's really interesting, one, just from a communication strategy standpoint. Starting this week in Scranton, I think, was very intentional by the president and his campaign for a number of reasons. One, it is simply a comfort zone place for the president. And everyone in elected office has a comfort zone kind of plays. It may be a comfort zone kind of crowd. It may be speaking to a certain think tank or a particular group or in a particular city where they have an affinity that kind of gives them energy back. And so I think it was interesting and intentional that the president began this week in Scranton. And the focus of this week is also interesting from the campaign standpoint. We'll talk about what he's doing from the governing standpoint, which is always the challenge for a sitting president, is how do you manage and do the daily duties of the office while you're running to get four more years in the office. This week, he's really contrasting and comparing the former president with his life. So kind of looking at some posturing in terms of President Biden being that man of the people, scrappy kid from Scranton, maybe his biggest go-to line of all of his go-to lines. And again, every politician has the go-tos, and that's his. And he draws some energy from that. And I think it's authentic. I think it's real. That was a part of his history and his story. And so this week he's really comparing and contrasting the scrappy kid from Scranton with Mar-a-Lago and the former president, where the lifestyles of the rich and famous kind of play out in real time there. So I want to play just a little bit of that just so you can get a sense of the president's focus this week. Again, from Scranton, he contrasted the rich and wealthy Donald Trump with his own roots in that scrappy place called Scranton.
You know, people like Donald Trump, you learn that telling people you're fired was something to laugh about. I guess that's how you look at the world when you're in Park Avenue in Mar-a-Lago. But if you grew up in a place like Scranton, nobody handed you anything. When I look at the economy, I don't see it through the eyes of Mar-a-Lago. I see it through the eyes of Scranton, and that's not hyperbole. That's a fact, where honesty and decency matter.
He posed Donald Trump as supporting tax-friendly policies for the rich while pursuing cuts to Social Security and Medicare benefits for everyone else.
How does Trump pay for these billionaire tax cuts? Recently said Social Security and Medicare, quote, there's a lot you can do in terms of cutting, end of quote. I got a better idea. Let's protect Social Security and Medicare and make the very wealthy begin to pay their fair share.
Now, we talked about that fair share on Monday, on tax day, no less. And it is interesting in terms of the percentages of who actually is paying the bulk, the lion's share. Now, what's the fair share? Where does that line actually belong? And unfortunately, a number of the things that the president repeated in his scrappy kid from Scranton speech are things that have been proved out across the political spectrum as not quite accurate in terms of what those making a lot of money are actually paying into the system, what percentage it is, those kinds of things. But to me, the more interesting component coming from the president is he's of course, making the case that he's the populist, that he's the one looking out for the little guy. Of course, the former president tries to make the same case that he's the one looking out for the little guy and that he's the populist person who's going to protect those folks. I don't think either one of them have been very convincing in terms of their actions, in terms of what's actually going on. I think one of the big challenges for the president, maybe the biggest challenge for the president, is while trying to tout many of his wins in terms of legislation being passed and enacted into law and what is actually happening for the American people. And the biggest challenge actually comes out of the government itself, saying that the Labor Department saying that if you have $100 today, if you had $100 in 2019, that same $100 today would only get you about $80 worth of stuff. So, in other words, about a 20% loss in the buying power, which is where the American people usually feel the economy and what they believe, their perception of what the economy actually is that gap of suddenly what I used to be able to fill up my shopping cart and didn't cost me that much. Now it's like 20% more, or I have to get 20% less. It's that putback factor of how often around the checkout lines are you seeing items that are being set aside or put back. And so that's the one that the president's going to have to counter as he goes through the week this week. Now, I did think it was very important today. The president made a very strong statement in support of Speaker of the House Mike Johnson's proposal for three separate bills providing aid to Ukraine, Israel, and then Taiwan, kind of the Indo-Pacific region. And he urged that they get those bills passed this week. He said the House must pass the package this week and the Senate should quickly follow. I'll sign into law immediately to send a message to the world that we stand with our friends and we won't let Iran, Russia succeed. Again, that's coming directly from President Biden. So that's an important moment there. Again, a bipartisan moment, the president reaching across the aisle. And, of course, the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, is doing a lot of mental gymnastics and a lot of jujitsu with the members of his own party. And they are trying to navigate getting that done. And the speaker, of course, trying to actually remain the speaker is also part of that. And so for the president to come out and say, I think that's a good approach. I can support that. I'll sign that into law. We haven't had a moment like that in a very, very long time where we've had a president of a different political party talking to the Speaker of the House of a different political party saying, yeah, I'm on board. You get that through, I'll sign it. Let's get that done. And so I applaud the president for that. I think that's an important statement. And it is a crucial one as we look at what's going on around the world in terms of Ukraine, Israel, Indo-Pacific, and then some humanitarian aid also going into Gaza as well. And so those are all interesting things on the political front as the president tries to move everything forward. I think the other big challenge for the president coming out this week is going to be around the fact that here we are simply in the month of April. So we're about 6 months into the fiscal year, which started on October the 1st. And 6 months into the spending for the year, we are already $1.1 trillion in the hole. So we already have a $1.1 trillion, and we're not even halfway through the fiscal year as a country. So that's one area where the president is going to have to deal with the math. And the math always wins and compound interest never stops. In fact, our friend George Will at the Washington Post pointed out this morning that thus far in the first 6 months, we have spent $429 billion on interest. We spent $433 billion on defense. So already, we are spending the equivalent of what we're spending on our defense budget on just interest payments on our $34 trillion of debt for the country. That's part of the problem. That's a discussion that Congress has got to get to because the math will win in the end, and the result is not going to be good for anybody. And that doesn't matter what the political scene is. That's just bad for the Republic. It's bad for all of the people of the country. All right, we're going to go ahead and step aside for some bottom of the hour news. Don't go anywhere. More Inside Sources coming up next on KSL News Radio. We'll be right back.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, as you know, we're always looking for people who are actually living the principles and who are out there making a difference. We've been sharing some of the experience I had last Friday at the 2024 Kindness Summit. I know we've talked about Utah as the crossroads to the West. We've talked about crossroads to the world. You may not have known it's also becoming known as the Crossroads of Kindness. It was an extraordinary event up at the University of Utah. Of course, Khosrow Semnani and the Semnani Family Foundation driving just an amazing thing. And one of the things I love about events like that is the bumpability factor. It's who you run into. It's who you get to know. And one of those that I bumped into who is out there making a difference. So excited to share this story with you today. So just wherever you are, just sit down, just soak this one in. Michelle West is the founder of Friends on the Spectrum and was part of the Kindness Summit up there at the University of Utah last week. One, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming into the studio. And give us first your first pass on the Kindness Summit last week.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Boyd, so much for having us today. Super excited to be here. I really loved the Kindness Summit. So being in corporate life for 20 years, I've been to plenty of summits. This one, I tell you what, every single speaker was able to share the ways that they essentially have been able to make kindness a career, like their way of life. Mm. And that really resonated with me. You know, just all of the busy and hubbub of getting a nonprofit set up. You feel like you're hanging by a thread sometimes. And I tell you, that day, I immersed myself in just feeling the energy that was there, was able to connect with incredible people like you, who genuinely the best MC ever. There was some really meaningful things and experiences that you shared. But also just to be able to meet others that are in this work, Khosrow Semnani, what an amazingly genuine guy. Like you can just feel.
Just a difference
maker. Yeah. So it was incredible. Super grateful to be a part of it.
Yeah, it was so good. It really is, as we're going through the day, it really is a way of being, and it's a way of seeing. And often we don't see those opportunities to make a difference. And sometimes we don't see those in our lives and in our community who we can be part of that kindness factor and make a difference. And you're a seer. you have seen our friends on the spectrum in a unique way. Tell us the origin story of that.
Absolutely. So I quit my job of 20 years in the corporate world, took this leap. Essentially, it started with my son. So our youngest son, Lucas, was diagnosed with autism when he was nearly 3. He's now 11. Mm. And, you know, when you get that diagnosis as a parent, you are grappling with understanding what does this mean for him? What does this mean for his future? Will he be able to go to school? Will he be able to speak? Our son didn't start saying words until he was 5, right? And so it's a very difficult journey that oftentimes your loved ones don't really understand it enough to really be able to kind of dig in and be present with my son and to give that support. So Friends on the Spectrum, super, super important to us because as we see Lucas continue to grow and he wants friends, he wants, you know, that social connectivity. It's difficult when you have a special needs child. You know, typically their classes have maybe 10 to 12 children, and oftentimes those children are pulled within a large area in the community, so it's not like they're in the neighborhood.
Right.
And then, you know, based on, you know, some of the gaps that he has in communicating things that are tough. We don't have a ton of faith in just allowing Lucas to run on over to the neighbor's house like we did with our neurotypical children, right? There's just a level of concern and, you know, a need or an obligation to protect them more than most. And so it's kind of heartbreaking. I've got two older kids. They're 16 and 14. That was my son's friend source when he was little, right? Mm-hmm. He kind of tag along as they played like children do. And now they're teenagers and they're dating and driving. And, you know, Lucas is stuck at home with old mom and old dad. And he's like, what are we going to do? And, you know, Clay and I, we're trying to rally. We're trying to create some fun for him. But it just becomes more and more heartbreaking about what does the future look like for him? You know, we know these kids get more and more isolated as they get older.
Yeah, I think that's such a big thing. The isolation, I think, is everything for all of us.
Right.
But especially for someone on the spectrum, I think that's such a powerful thing. And so you saw that, you were experiencing that, and then you did what all great individuals and leaders and people who get it do. You jumped into that parentheses of the crazy idea.
Right.
And you created a space where our friends on the spectrum could gather and connect, and that their parents could get the kind of resources they need as well.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, growing up, I had an older brother, and both, you know, and my parents as well would say, hey, if you think something should be done, if not you, then who? And so that continued to just ring in my mind for, years until finally my husband Clay and I, who is just my right-hand guy in all of this and supports me. And, you know, we essentially said, we've got to do it.
Yeah.
It's up to us. It's not going to be created. And so we set up Friends on the Spectrum. We actually had our grand opening March 23rd. So just not too long ago. And we've been able to, you know, facilitate a few weeks of our social groups. So you've got these children in there. We basically create, you know, these connection opportunities for special needs children ages 2 to 20. And we obviously kind of facilitate those at different times. And it has been amazing already to see the progress, to see the growth. Lucas, my little guy, came home from school and he goes, is it my gloop today? It was his group that day.
Yeah.
He now has his own place to be every week, right as rain.
Yeah.
You know, he's tagging along with me for soccer, lacrosse, whatever else. He has his thing just for him. And it's been amazing to see already the excitement and confidence that he has to go and just have a good time.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
So powerful. So powerful. Talk to me for a second about some of the resources for parents, because talk about being isolated.
Yes.
Often the parents feel isolated, not having answers, wondering about the future. How do we do this? What are some of the things that you're providing for the parents of our friends on the spectrum?
So I'm super grateful. We have been able to build a partnership with Lori Krasny. So Lori Krasny is a therapist who has over 40 years of experience in working with children on the spectrum. This gal, she is an angel on earth. And, you know, fortunately, my husband Clay and I, 9 years ago, we were able to find this course, this eight-week parent course, where we were able to meet with Lori. And, you know, I remember what really resonated with us that first day. We were going around. She facilitates small groups so you can get kind of vulnerable and share your, you know, specific situations. And after we did that, tears in our eyes, all like shocked and terrified of what lies ahead, Lori said, "I want each of you to know your children have incredible potential. They are beautiful souls and they will learn and grow and progress. You just don't understand their operating system. They're kind of like a Mac computer in a PC world."
Yeah.
"And I'm going to help you understand their operating system."
Oh, I love that.
So you can imagine the relief as a parent and in her sharing that and giving us that vote of confidence to know there is a better way for you to understand these children. She shares perspectives. She provides skills for us as parents that allow us to create meaningful and joyful interactions and connections with our children.
Oh, I love that.
And so I would, you know, Clay and I would both still say this is still 9 years later, the most impactful, you know, training support that we received. And so Lori, she recently retired from her job at one of the school districts in the Valley, and she facilitates this 8-week course for us. We're 4 weeks in now, and the parents just continue to come up like, "Oh, you could never know."
Yeah.
It's like a mindset shift. It's not just tips and tricks. You view your child differently.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing. I'm super grateful for her.
Where can people go to get more information?
Yeah. So you can go to friendsonthespectrum.org. Right at the top of the website, you will see a button that says sign up for social groups, play groups each week. So there's an online scheduling portal there. And also you will be able to look at media clips, you know, situations that have already been, you know, been able to come to fruition for us. Great opportunities there. And then our services, and that will essentially let you know what we offer. And, you know, feel free to reach out to us.
Awesome.
You can call us directly.
Fantastic. Yeah. Friendsonthespectrum.org is the place to go. This is one of those holy ground spaces where you see these kids come together, often for the first time, feeling connected to something, part of something, a place to go that is their own. It's an extraordinary mission. It's extraordinary organization, extraordinary leadership. Michelle West, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Boyd.
All right. We'll step aside for a quick commercial break. We'll come back. More Inside Sources coming up next. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
We're really pleased to have joining us on the program today. Frank Glatz is the founder and CEO of Contact Organics in Australia and has found his way to not just the United States, but right to the state of Utah, down to St. George for an important event happening. We've been covering that here on Inside Sources, talking about all the things in the agriculture space and just some great innovation that's going on. Of course, our friends over at World Trade Center Utah and Arielle is the sponsor of this summit and event. And Frank, welcome to the Beehive State and looking forward to this conversation. Tell us, give us a little bit of the background on your company, on Contact Organics, and what it is that connected you to the Beehive State.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for inviting me on the program. As said beforehand, so I'm the managing director or CEO and founder of Contact Organics. Contact Organics is an Australian AgTech startup company. We have developed a breakthrough innovation in non-toxic weed control that delivers significant impact on the environment, on food chains and public health. In summary, we have developed a non-toxic weed killer from natural ingredients that works and is really good for the soil. If you look in the context of the global AgTech market, the global herbicide market is worth $40 billion. It's huge. Mm. And chemical herbicides that usually kill weeds, they're toxins. So therefore, when you spray them to kill weeds, you have a real impact on the environment, soil, water-wise, and even on your body.
Yeah.
So we have developed a proprietary delivery technology to make natural active ingredients bioavailable and really applied that to bioherbicidal products. Through our application formulation development, we really achieve effectiveness and efficiencies like leading chemical herbicides. Our target markets are regenerative agriculture. We do crop desiccation. We work in vineyards, horticulture, commercial landscaping, home market, garden markets. Where the company is at the moment, we years of work, but we have just received the US EPA registration for our Firehawk bioherbicide product. So we are ready to sell now. We have developed more and more product to get the right cost structures. We have got a lot of patents. We're at that point of our bioherbicide market launch. So we're working on preparing the launch and then ramping up sales and get going in the U.S. market.
Oh, that's fantastic. And you're part of this group that's down in St. George this week. And just a unique group of startups and innovative organizations that are down there. Tell us about, I know there's you, there's companies from several different countries down there.
Yes.
What is it about Utah that makes this a great place for that agritech community?
Well, if you look, firstly, we're in St. George, and this is an amazing place. I just love to get up this morning, go for a walk, and breathe a lot of fresh air. So the whole atmosphere and feel of the place is great. As you said, I'm participating in the Start AgriTech program that's organized by Frontier and Ariely here at the Edward Innovation Plaza at Utah Tech. And what the Start AgriTech program does, it connects AgriTech startup companies with potential business partners, mentors, Utah government representatives, investors. So we're meeting at the moment a lot of amazing people that we engage with and learn from. It's great to have a chance to exchange and to network and really get very active in this whole kind of field here.
Yeah.
So if you look on Utah, it's obviously a great place to do business. The people that we're meeting, they really have a can-do attitude. The government is very supportive of AgTech startup business and it's very accessible. During this program here, I was able to talk to Craig Butters, the Utah Commissioner of Agriculture, and introduce him to our product. So it's a great opportunity to engage. We're working at Utah Tech, which have great facilities here. The Innovation Center is quite amazing, so it's great cooperation partners. If I look at Utah, I think you have a great central location in the U.S. Our business, we will sell a lot of products as we go forward in horticultural applications in California. And, of course, here from Utah, you have great access to the West Coast. I can really imagine Utah as a very strong location for our U.S. business with all the industrial and logistics kind of location. The depth of knowledge and appreciation of AgTech in this community is really making a difference. You can really feel people know what they're talking about. So it's great experience.
That's fantastic. And as we like to say, they used to refer to Utah as just the crossroads of the West. We think it's become the crossroads to the world now.
Absolutely. We love it here because Utah, by the way, has become an important lead market for our business in the U.S. So our non-toxic herbicides, already we have a distributor up in Heber Valley, and our non-toxic herbicides are already used in Park City, in their parks and gardens, golf courses. They're using it in sensitive natural areas. So we have already Utah Valley University is using our product, or Soldier Hollow Carter School, they're using the product in sports fields. So they're really... Heber Valley Farms and homeowners using it. So people are obviously very concerned about the environment and looking at ways of doing the right thing.
Yeah.
That's right.
Oh, fantastic. Great insight, great perspective. Frank Glatz, founder, CEO of Contact Organics, really doing some extraordinary things that are both good for the ag business and good for the environment. We love to have those compatible principles and show that this is how you can make it happen. This is how you get it done. part of an extraordinary event happening down in St. George this week. Ariely, of course, is a lead sponsor there in terms of the summit, and just some great things in terms of initiatives, innovation, and crucial conversations going on down there. Public can participate coming up on Thursday this week with some of the really interesting entrepreneurial pitches that'll be made down there. Frank, we're so grateful you came across. That's a long journey, I know, from Melbourne, and we're glad you're here. You hope you have a fantastic stay and look forward for your business to thrive and to have Utah as a part of that success story. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, that wraps up hour number one of Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. We're going to step aside for some top of the hour news, but don't go anywhere. When we come back, we're going to talk about progress, progressivism, and what does that actually look like, and how do we actually get back to innovation? Stick around. We'll be right back.
KSL FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios, this is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
We don't have to look very far to see the headlines filled with a lot of the cynicism that is plaguing more than just our politics these days. Our everyday lives have been weighed down by complacency, mindlessly taking kind of the world-changing inventions of the 21st century for granted, a lot of the progress that has been made. But I think it's crucial for us to get underneath those headlines and that negativity and look at what is the path back to really embracing innovation, the optimism, and the progress that we're all about. Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Well, it's time to think again about what you think you know when it comes to progress. Brilliant piece at Reason.com today. Ronald Bailey's the science correspondent for Reason. And his piece today was maybe my favorite piece of the day today in terms of just thinking through where are we, what we take for granted today, and then how do we make sure we re-enthrone that innovation and both celebration of past progress and pushing forward to new? How do we go about that? And Ronald, welcome to the program.
Delighted to be with you. I want to warn your listeners, I'm getting over a cold, so I might sound a little rough, but thank you for having me.
And that is part of the price of progress, Ron, is you have to play hurt some days, and we are grateful that you're playing hurt for us today and in the game. For our listeners, give us just kind of a baseline, and you talk about this, the fact that we are the beneficiaries of a lot of progress, and sometimes that gives us a kind of pessimistic view of the future.
Yes, that was what sort of motivated the article entitled Progress Rediscovered that I did at Reason, is I've been casting around and became aware that there are a whole bunch of new young groups of think tanks and websites and so forth that actually are embracing the notion that we can, if you will, pursue with gusto and elan technological, scientific, and industrial progress again. They really are in favor of economic growth. They are trying to fight against a cultural pessimism that seems to have pervaded the current few decades in the United States. And I think it's just very exciting.
Yeah, I love that. And there are so many things that have been pointing to a lot of the things you pointed out in your piece of kind of the view that not many think it will be better for their kids than it was for them, and the generation beyond that will be worse. And some think we're just in a death spiral, just waiting to hit bottom. But tell us about this optimistic opposition that you described. Who are these folks? Who are these groups? And what are they starting to do?
Well, I specifically focused on four different groups. The Roots of Progress, which is a group that is trying to develop, if you will, the intellectual base for the new ideology of progress, if you will. The Institute for Progress, which is in Washington, D.C., and they're more of an organization that's trying to get into the nitty-gritty of how science funding works and how the federal government works and try to figure out how to get rid of the overburden of regulation that's gumming up the works, if you will. And then there's the Progress Network, which is, again, trying to align people from all ideological viewpoints, but who are definitely looking to the future of a technological and scientific progress. And then there's a wonderful publication called Works in Progress, which is trying to, if you will, identify problems and how they can be solved and do it in a deep, effective way and with good policy proposals out there. And these are all relatively young groups of people, and I was very excited to be able to talk with them and interview them. And basically, I believe that they're coalescing into a new progress movement, which could lead us out of the current gloom and doom into a much better future.
Yeah, I think that's so vital that we get out of this doom scrolling kind of space that we're in. And I also love the fact that you took time to just pause and say, hey, there's been some pretty amazing progress going on, not just here in the U.S. over the last couple hundred years, but there's a lot of progress. There's never been more opportunities. I think we often take advantage or take for granted the fact that we got nice hot running water and an internet that works and all of those kinds of things. How do we start to change the dynamic and the dialogue to really allow groups like this to be unleashed and to make sure we go at progress in a way that isn't either just government-dominated, kind of a Wilsonian approach to it, but has enough structure and support to it that it can actually help pull society forward?
Well, one of the things that you have identified is, again, the overburden of regulation, where you can't build anything anywhere anymore in the United States because of all of the red tape that's accumulated around various projects and so forth. That would be a huge blow in the direction of, once again, freeing up entrepreneurs and market forces to start bringing new projects and new technologies forward. And this is one of the things that these groups are working on, for example. But again, one of the things I also think is helpful, and you mentioned that a little bit earlier, is reminding people of where we came from. And right now, it always sounds like it's terrible. We don't have a lot of things, but if you go back even 50 years ago, Americans were only about a third as rich as they are now. The internet came into existence. The new vaccines are available now. The infant mortality rate was even higher in those days. The number of people who are highly educated around the world is increasing at all times. And here's some amazing statistics to me is life expectancy at the year 1900 for planet Earth was about 35 years. It's now over 70 years and increasing, which is a huge improvement of what it is to be a human being and a human prospects. And all of this is what these groups are trying to do. As Jason Crawford says, what they're trying to do is to create, if you will, a vision of an ambitious technological future that we want to live in and are excited to build. And I think that they're actually going to succeed at that. It will take a while. The voices of cultural despair are hard to displace, but I think that we can get there, and I think these folks will be helping us to do that.
Yeah, it's true. The negative voices are loud and feel like they're everywhere, but I think in the end, I think there are going to be those who recognize we always refer to it in the context of America was born within the parentheses of a crazy idea. And that's how progress begins. It's not when things are set and settled. It's when things are far from certain, but someone's willing to take a risk and believe in that possibility. Just in our last minute here, give us something you're watching for moving forward and how we get past the pessimism and get to that optimism as a society.
As a technology or as a cultural trend?
Let's start with the cultural trend.
Again, I would like to say that these groups, I think, are at the forefront of that, and they're not alone. There are other groups like the Breakthrough Institute that are working on this, a fabulous group of folks at the Libertarian Cato Institute called Human Progress are also getting the message out and that kind of thing. I think, again, as one of the people I interviewed, Solange Dottani, who works at Works in Progress, she calls herself an impatient optimist. And that's what these people are, patient optimists. And I think that we all need to be a patient optimist and just push forward through the cultural negativity and the voices of despair that are still sort of dominant in our culture at the moment.
This is a great piece. Everybody should go check this out at Reason.com today. Ronald Bailey, science correspondent for Reason. Fantastic piece. Thanks for playing Hurt. Thanks for joining us today. That's what progress sounds like.
Thank you very much for having me.
So important. And the final thing that he shared in his piece was that pessimism is more arrogant than optimism. And it's that optimism is just knowing that we're capable of solving problems. Pessimism is the conviction that we can't. I believe we've got to think again about what's possible.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
So many of the headlines continue to swirl around the Middle East and around Gaza in particular, and it has touched so many different places and spaces around the world in terms of the geopolitics and also the politics right here at home. And as we look at President Biden's reelection campaign, of course, he's doing a little sprint across Pennsylvania this week as part of that. And in the meantime, a lot of the challenges that the president is going to face in that reelection bid will actually be in the Middle East and Gaza in particular. Gaza's been dividing Democrats in some very interesting and unique ways. Ronald Brownstein, of course, is the senior editor at The Atlantic, senior political analyst for CNN, one of the best in the business, and wrote a fantastic piece digging into what this really is, what it means, the challenges the Biden administration has had and the president himself has had in terms of navigating and threading the needle when it comes to Israel and Gaza. And Ronald, thanks so much for making time for us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So give us kind of your lay of the land in terms of how the president has approached this and some of the challenges that it's creating for him, not across the political spectrum, but really within the center of his own party.
Yeah. Well, as you said, I mean, it is a highly complex challenge from both a political and a policy standpoint. And there are no entirely safe courses of action for the president in terms of the domestic politics. But I think the kind of the summary of what we've seen is that Biden's instincts about Israel were formed in an earlier generation. And his kind of inclination, his first step, you know, as we would say of an outfielder, is always to emphasize his support for the country and his theory. When the conflict began, you remember the phrase, he was going to bear hug Netanyahu and try to influence him by staying as close as possible. The problem he's got is that his instincts are very different than the dominant view in his party today, both about Israel in general and its degree of vulnerability in the region, and particularly about Netanyahu, who has identity. You know, I've been covering national politics since the 1980s, and I don't think there is any foreign leader who has identified as closely with one of the U.S. political parties as Netanyahu has with the Republican Party over the years. Only one in 20 Democrats in polling say they have a favorable view of Netanyahu. And so the president has kind of been caught between his instinct to resist confrontation, to resist imposing conditions on Israel, and the growing unease in his party, but also in the center of the electorate among independents about the way Israel has conducted this war. He has seemed a step behind. And in terms of, you know, kind of matching where the public is going, particularly in his own party. And as a result, as I say in the story, I think he is facing more internal dissent inside the Democratic coalition over the way he's handled this than a Democratic president has faced over any foreign policy decision, really, since Vietnam.
Yeah. And I want to unpack that a little bit. But before I do that, I want to get the first step is such a crucial thing. And bonus points for the baseball reference. But often the president has found that first step has often ended up in a backpedal and a lot of confusing messaging in terms of, you know, saying this, but then doing that. Sometimes he feels a little more like the British Bobby, who's unarmed, yelling stop or all yell stop again. And that seems to be creating confusion both within the party But also on the international stage, in terms of what is the policy, what's the agenda? Is this a de-escalate at any cost problem? And is that creating more confusion than clarity, again, even within his own party?
Well, as we said, he is extremely reluctant to have anything approaching a fundamental breach with Israel. And he is extremely reluctant to back his words with consequences. So, you know, as we have seen, I think both as a result of political pressure in his own coalition, that's undeniable, but also because of a genuine policy reaction to the way the Netanyahu government has pursued this war and what they've said about the aftermath, he's moved toward more of a rhetorical public criticism of Israel's approach to this. But he has not married that to actual consequences. And so you have more and more, we're up to about 20 Senate Democrats, 56 House Democrats, urging him to suspend the delivery of offensive weapons until certain changes happen. Importantly, you know, no one is really calling, no one that I'm aware of, or at least that, you know, the mainstream of the party is calling for the suspension of defensive weapons, like the Iron Dome that Israel employed over the weekend with Iran. Even though that distinction is pretty clear in terms of the positioning, it's a little more murky in terms of the policy. The F-15s, for example, that Israel is seeking, were also, the U.S. used F-15s to shoot down some of the incoming missiles. The Iran attack has probably pushed back this confrontation within the party to a degree. It has kind of delayed it, I think. But May 8th is a date that you should circle, because under pressure from some of those Democratic senators earlier this year, the Biden administration issued a national security memorandum that requires them to report to Congress on May 8th about whether all allies, but certainly pointedly Israel, are using U.S. weapons in accordance with international law, and whether they are cooperating with the distribution not only of U.S. aid, but international aid that the U.S. supports. And it is, you know, I think the sponsors, the senators who advanced that idea and negotiated it with the administration, think it is going to be very hard for them to certify that Israel has done so, particularly on the aid front.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Well, we're going to watch that May 8th very closely. Help us unpack for a second the impact on the younger voters. And again, we know it will be a close election. And this is not these people are going to, you know, switch parties and vote for former President Trump. But this is more, do people become disconnected and not show up? And in a close election in those seven battleground states, for sure, that could be the difference from between re-election and packing it up.
Yes, absolutely. And particularly, as I'll say in a moment, Michigan is a particular problem. And it is a very difficult state for Biden to replace if he can't win it. I mean, there is a way to replace it, but it's not easy. Look, young voters have never been that enthusiastic about Biden. They weren't in the 2020 primaries. They rallied to him against Trump in the 2020 election. His approval rating among them has never been great. And this provides this represents just one more hurdle that he's got to get over. You know, there is, you know, in the polling, opposition to the way Israel has conducted the war and resistance to sending them more offensive weapons is as high among young people as it is among any other group. And as you say, the issue the Democratic pollsters and strategists are worried about is not so much that large numbers of them will flip over and vote for Trump, because Trump would, if anything, be even more deferential to Netanyahu. And Stephen Miller, his top immigration advisor, is openly tweeting pictures of pro-Palestinian demonstrations and saying ICE will be busy in 2025 deporting people is what he means. But the fear is that you know, when they're not that enthusiastic to begin with, that this may provide another reason at the margin for people to stay home or splinter to the many third party options they have. I also think Michigan is a particular problem, you know, where you have that large Arab American population, which is not by itself, I don't think, large enough to tip the state. But the all the protest that is centered in those communities like Dearborn just keeps this in the news more, in that state. And I thought it was a worrisome for Biden straw in the wind that the University of Michigan president the other about 2 weeks ago felt they had to impose new unilateral restrictions on protest on campus because the protests against the war had been so intense and widespread. If that level of activism is happening at Ann Arbor, you know, that is not a good thing for Biden because, you know, winning Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin is the surest path for him to get back to 270 electoral college votes. If he doesn't win Michigan, he has to win either Georgia, which looks very hard, North Carolina, which looks very hard, or both Arizona and Nevada, which is probably the best option of the three, but is no guarantee either. So the Michigan problem is a concentrated version of the youth problem nationally, and it's compounded by the Arab American problem.
Yeah. Fantastic perspective, as always. Great piece. You need to go check that out at The Atlantic, theatlantic.com today. Ronald Brownstein, senior editor at The Atlantic, senior political analyst for CNN, one of the great thinkers and someone who has watched this for a long time and has great depth, insight, and wisdom in terms of what all of this means and how this will play out. Thank you so much for making time for us today.
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for the kind words, and have a good rest of the week.
All right. That's Ronald Brownstein again from The Atlantic. Some really fascinating perspective. And it's one of those, again, you look at just the headlines, it's the headlines. But if you get underneath the headlines, you can start to think again about what you think you know. And Ronald does that with the best of them. We'll step aside for one last break. More Inside Sources coming up next.
Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson. And as we round out the program today, if you missed any of the segments along the way, just go to the podcast. You can pick them up there. And one of the podcasts you're going to definitely want to watch for and listen to is a conversation we had earlier in the day today with Ronald Bailey from Reason.com talking about progress and why it's such a vital thing and how we view it. That is so important. So I want to go back to that conversation for a minute and add a few components. He concluded his piece at Reason.com saying pessimism is more arrogant than optimism. Optimism is simply that we know for a fact that we're capable of solving problems. Pessimism is the conviction that we're not. So the future isn't worse unless people stop trying to make it better. And all the doom scrolling you can do during the course of your day can make you wonder if it's even worth it to get out of bed in the morning. But we live in a day and in a time where we are the beneficiaries of such extraordinary progress. The fact that you're listening to me at this moment is progress. The fact that you've got a device that fits in your pocket that can access information and people all around the planet instantly, that's progress. The fact that more people have been lifted out of poverty over our lifetimes than probably at any point in history, that's progress. So all of these things we have to be careful of because it's easy to get in that doom scroll, doom loop, downward spiral that is pessimism. And it's so fascinating to me that we get so wrapped up in what's wrong. I am a warts and all guy when it comes to history and when it comes to the state of the country and the state of our communities. But I'm not just a warts guy. Warts and all, yes, but you got to see it all, not just warts. If all you're talking about is the warts, the problems, what is wrong, then you end up with this very distorted view. And one of the things that Ronald Bailey pointed out to us today was the fact that, one, we have a lot to celebrate. The fact that you climbed out of a bed, or probably a really comfortable bed this morning, that you had hot water to take a shower, that you had food that you could actually eat that was nutritious, all of those things are great signs of progress. But it's so interesting, in all the polling, there are very few Americans who think that their children's lives will be better than their own, or that things will continue to progress. And that's a dangerous space for a country that was built within the parentheses of a crazy idea. That we could have freedom, that we could have self-government, that we could have a constitutional republic that would allow everyone to pursue their own version of their American dream. And it's easy. It is so easy. There's no requirement to be a negative. It's the easiest thing on the planet. Poking holes, unraveling things, going down to that lowest common denominator, that's the easy stuff. But what we have to get to is we have to get beyond this cultural pessimism and get to the fact that we can solve big problems. We can do big things. We've done it. We're doing it today. And whether it's in science and technology, whether it's in the arts, there are all kinds of opportunities. And so we should be optimistic. And having that kind of optimism, I think, is the essence of where we've got to get. It's interesting that whenever an individual or a business decides that they've made it, or that they're at the top of the scale, that's when progress actually stops. If you think you're at the pinnacle, where do you go? I have always said during my years of business consulting that the most dangerous day in the life of an organization is the day they're successful, the day they hit number one, the day they grab market share, the day they soundly beat the competition. Why? Because it's so easy to get fat on big ego and rest on your laurels, and then you stop progressing. And it is difficult for businesses and for societies, for that matter, to outlive their own success. In fact, here in America, we really are trying to become one of the few societies in history to outlive their own success. History doesn't lie, and history isn't too kind to all kinds of societies that achieve some extraordinary greatness, amazing success. Mayan Empire, Roman Empire, British Empire, there's a whole slew of them that did incredibly well. And then for one reason or another, they unraveled. And usually they unraveled because they stopped progressing. Or they began to buy into the fact that they couldn't progress, or that they couldn't solve big problems, that things got complicated, that there was gridlock, that the difficult issues of the day got pushed on to the next generation. And then they start to fracture, because if you can't get things done, if you can't progress, you got to have somebody to blame. And so then you go tribal, and then you have division, and then you have contempt. And if any of this sounds familiar, it should, because we're in it. And so I think it's important for us to recognize, one, all the progress we have made. Perfection, heavens no. Big, major challenges, big, major issues we need to deal with, absolutely. I believe it was Henry Ford who said that the obstacles are those frightful things you see when you take your eye off of the goal. And so I think we have to rethink about that in terms of what we're looking at, what we're looking for. Are we looking to validate a belief that we're a country in decline, that we have nowhere to go but down? Or are we going to tap back into that innovative spirit that sparked the beginning of this nation, so that we can get back to innovation, so that we can get back to creativity, so that we can get back to coming together as a society to do big things, to solve big problems? The big problems and the progress are not going to be found in the marbled halls of Congress or some big government solution. They're going to be found in your backyard and mine, across the fence, in the neighborhood and community. Because that's where progress has always started. That's where it always has to stay. That wraps it up for us on Inside Sources today here on KSL News Radio. I am Boyd Matheson. Thanks for joining us. And as always, as you go out into the world today, make sure you see something that inspires, say something that uplifts, and do something that makes a difference.
KSL FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios, this is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.